I'm just going to finish off the discussion of many worlds, and then we'll move on to collapse models. So I just want to go through a few criticisms of the approach. So the first one is to do with whether or not the many worlds really explains probabilities. Well, there's a number of people who have claimed that the arguments of Wallace held up and rework.
Yeah, so a number of people have claimed that the approach of Wallace doesn't work. So Adrian Kent, David Albert. And basically what these arguments do is they say, well, why do we have to use the particular measure, the psi squared measure that Wallace obtains? And they give arguments for alternative possible measurements. So, for example, Hugh Price has a way of treating all descendants equally. So if you're at a particular point in the branching structure, then you have ahead of you lots of different paths, then all those different paths should be treated equally according to this argument. And of course, although Wallace has a theorem, so he has a, you can't criticize that, you can still question the various assumptions that go into that theorem. So I think the jury is still out on this, and lots of people have given convincing arguments against what Wallace has tried to do. So you can look at the conference I mentioned that's on PERSA from a few years ago, where people present these different arguments. So that's the first issue of criticism. Second issue. The one that bothers me most, which is that, it's distasteful. I was explaining to my wife the many worlds interpretation as we were about to have a dinner, a nice steak dinner, and she told me to stop because it was putting her off her dinner. And I think if you really have a visceral understanding of what the many worlds interpretation is saying, then that's the only natural reaction. Pretty much anything that you can imagine that has a non-zero amplitude, and that's pretty much anything, will actually happen in the many worlds interpretation. So I can imagine all sorts of wonderful things, but I can also imagine all sorts of horrible things as well. And all those horrible things really, really happen in Emmanuel's interpretation. If you have a stochastic model, so not all the branches happen, just one of them happens, then although you can imagine all the horrible things that might happen, afterwards only one of those things happen, and you can have the sense that you got away with it, you know, that only one of those things happened. There's no such sense in Emmanuel's interpretation.
Why should the horrible things be given more weight than the wonderful things?
Oh, I mean, they're not. I mean, maybe actually it looks like, at least from where we stand now, perhaps mostly it's more wonderful things that are likely to happen, you know, than horrible things. Depends how you feel about these seminars, these lectures. But the point is that there's not the weight is really irrelevant in some sense, because it really happens. Something that really happens has, you know.
But you could say it's sustainable. You can also say it's great, because look at the unicorn. Like,
sure, that's right. Yeah, you have.
There's no reason for you to say that.
Yeah, I mean, there will for sure probably be unicorns, at least horses with sort of malformation. But yeah, it depends how you feel. I kind of find my enjoyment of all the wonderful things that might happen is sort of slightly ruined by the really terrible things. It's a matter of taste. And obviously, this is not really a sort of a rational criticism. It's more of a kind of subjective, that's the word I'm looking for, criticism, yeah. I remember once I was driving and there was a blowout, and I just about managed to pull the car over to the side, I got away with it. But I'm sure that if the Emmanuel's interpretation was correct, then actually I didn't, and there are many worlds in which something more horrible happened. And from a moral point of view, isolation from a horrible thing isn't really a reason not to be horrified by it. You know, in the Emmanuel's interpretation, of course, you're isolated from the different branches. You can't, for all practical purposes, ever come to have any direct causal connection with them, but still, they're there. I've suddenly, people talk, when people talk about many worlds, not so much, I mean, I haven't seen this in academic papers, but I think, Bartok, people suddenly make this argument. I think it's worth spelling it out, because it's there in the back of people's minds, and it's worth being aware of what view of reality you're committing yourself to if you go with many worlds, and certainly, I'm just trying to underline the fact that you really have to believe these other worlds happen, in their full blazing colors. It's definitely a reason not to like it, yeah. So that's right, yeah. So this is really not irrational, so just to finish. Criticism. And certainly the proponents of many worlds would answer, this is true, but the equations force you, nevertheless, to the many worlds interpretation, and that the situation is very similar to the Copernican revolution, when suddenly the Earth was no longer at the center of the cosmos, but the Sun was, and that was having our planet at the center was a very cozy, nice feeling for people who believed in that point of view, and yet physics forced us to adopt a different point of view, a much less cozy one. So so this isn't really a rational criticism, obviously.
You say it's not really rational criticism, but you still say that it is a criticism. But many words could be right or not, mm-hmm. with whether or not it is successful.
That's right, yeah.
There's all the things happening on Earth right now. It doesn't mean that Earth doesn't exist.
That's right. That's true. Yeah. I mean, there are many distasteful things happening right now, without having to use the many worlds interpretation. You have to go to North Korea or somewhere to find such things. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. If you want to be happy, then maybe you wouldn't choose this from that point of view.
If many worlds is correct, then there's a world where you chose it anyway.
That is true. Yeah. So I guess what I'm trying to do here is, the first issue I mentioned is a really substantial technical issue with the program, and the jury is still out on whether that has really been solved or not. As I said at the beginning, I'm really an anti-advocate of the many worlds approach, and so you should suitably interpret my what I'm trying to do here. The second one is really just to point out just how, if you're committing yourself to this point of view, you're really committing yourself to something quite serious. And then the third criticism. Let me keep all those criticisms close to each other. Is that in some sense it's unstable to possible progress in physics. So the key feature of the many worlds, the key feature of quantum theory that the many worlds approach sort of latches onto is the fact that you have unitary evolution of the quantum state, and it's quite likely that that will disappear as we have some kind of progress in physics, perhaps on the problem of quantum gravity. So there are certainly reasons to believe that quantum gravity will be non-unitary. And I'll talk about some of those reasons later today. So the very feature of quantum theory in which the many worlds approach sort of takes gets its kind of weirdness from is something that may disappear. Suddenly, personally, this is my biggest hope. That's how we can avoid having to believe in something that is distasteful in this way. Okay, and of course, there are many more things you could possibly, many more problems you could have with the many worlds interpretation. You could ask whether really this decoherence argument for the branching structure works. You could say, well, really, the quantum state isn't a description of reality; it's some sort of epistemic object, you can have many more objections. Okay. Any questions, comments before I move on to the next topic?
So you could say it also enables, it solves some problem, let's say, smaller tools, but it solves some fine-tuning problems while the constants of nature.
Oh, right, yeah, that's sort of that particular branch, yeah, yeah. That's true, yeah. Although
it doesn't, there's some laws of physics that won't vary. This isn't like a string multiverse, right? Like H bar, for instance, is fixed in the Schrodinger equation.
H bar is dimensionful, so it doesn't matter what.
But, it's true that, like, within the many walls interpretation, you're usually imagining just a given Hamiltonian, some fixed fundamental Hamiltonian that evolves the state. So you'd have to sketch out how that was really going to work. Yeah, because in the string theory landscape, it's a different kind of argument,
yeah,
I think.
No, I'm not talking about that.
Yeah.
I just remember reading some articles about
mm-hmm.
how cosmology works well with many worlds.
Right.
Kind of counter this.
Right.
Issue.
Right, yeah. I mean, certainly many cosmologists believe the many worlds approach because if they're going to write down a wave function for the universe, then this is the most natural ontology for that. Yeah.
But, if you want to accept many worlds, kind of like quantum mechanics is all you have, and QFT is kind of the natural extension. So the fact that we've had so much trouble mixing QFT with gravity,
mm-hmm.
I mean, to me at least, that spells a problem.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's sort of what I'm saying here, that we haven't successfully found the theory of quantum gravity yet, and that it's likely we have to go to a deeper, quite different theory, and then unitary evolution won't be a part of it. Yeah. I mean, this goes back to what I was saying earlier that. In a sense, interpreting quantum theory may just be an academic exercise because if quantum theory isn't the correct theory of nature, then there's a limit to how useful, there's a limit to how much you should believe any given interpretation of quantum theory if we can have a completely different looking theory at some point in the future. Just as much as if you believe completely in some interpretation of Newtonian physics, then you would have been, you may have not been doing the right thing. So physics can change, and so we shouldn't perhaps worry too much about these kinds of things until we feel that we're in a better situation. Of course, we're never actually going to have the final theory necessarily. But there's a lot of reasons to think that quantum theory is just has got some serious problems, and so we perhaps shouldn't worry too much about finding the right interpretation at this stage. I think the role of this interpretation is more. That it helps you think about quantum theory and some of these conceptual issues, and that those, that could help you find your way to the next physical theory. So that by extracting principles and properties of quantum theory that you might want to preserve, you may be in a better position to obtain the next theory. Yeah, go ahead.
So what you're saying is that criticism three applies to any interpretation.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, there's particular reasons. In this case, because there's these arguments that I'll come to shortly that say, well, the unitary evolution doesn't really make sense when you have the presence of gravity. So there's particular reasons to think that the many worlds interpretation is going to be undermined. But yes, you're right. I mean, so the de Broglie-Bohm model to the, to all the different approaches. Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Someday we'll extend quantum theory to a more general one.
Mm-hmm.
Still, we'll have to reduce to quantum theory.
Absolutely, yeah.
Energy, or energy. And then we still have all of these interpretations.
Yeah, but it might be that. But it might be that the more detailed sort of fundamental theory actually provides a more natural interpretation that tells us. Something much deeper than these interpretations are doing. But I think you're right in the sense that if something of the spirit of these different approaches may be preserved in the interpretation of the final one. So maybe you'll have hidden variables things that come to play the role of hidden variables if you take the limit of the more fundamental theory towards quantum theory. Perhaps.
Is that a good argument about systemic
variables? Well, definitely it's an argument to look at those kinds of models because they may teach you something. I think one thing that the quantum foundations community hasn't done very well is take the sort of insights that come from these different interpretations and these theorems and really apply it to the problem of building, of constructing new theories. And of course, there's lots of people in this building who are trying to do that, you know, quantum gravity, the string theorists, and so on. And they're not using any of these, but they're not generally taking these kinds of insights. But the quantum foundations community, I think, has failed also really to do that as well. But I think there's a lot of potential there for doing physics in this way. Okay, I better move on. So I'm going to talk about collapse models next. So the names associated with these are Perl, Girardi, Rimini, Weber, or Bieber, and various other people. And I'll talk about the model that Girardi, Rimini, and Weber came up with in some detail. So the idea, or the motivation at least, is to solve the measurement problem by explicitly modifying the Schrodinger equation. And the idea is this. We want to find a modification of the Schrodinger equation, which is such that if you have a small object, the kind of object for which you would typically see quantum interference, then this is hardly influenced at all by the modification. So we still see interference. And other quantum effects. Whereas for a large object, like a pointer on a measurement apparatus, we'd expect it to be, we want the modification of Schrodinger's equation to be such that these things are strongly influenced by the modification. So we get definite pointer states and so on. So here's a possible physical justification for this kind of collapse. I mentioned it earlier, coming from gravity. So this is this comes from the Ossie originally, and then Roger Penrose later. Well, so the version I'm going to give is the argument I'll give is the one that Penrose gave. So imagine we have some massive object. And for Penrose, massive has a particular meaning, but it's going to be something which is comparable with the Planck mass, which is, I forget exactly what it is, I think it's not that big. It's sort of a fraction of a gram. I think it's 10 to the minus 6 grams, something like that. And so you could see it, but only, you know, you could see an object which is this big, just about. Much bigger than an atom or an electron. So you take some object like this, and now you put it into a superposition, having gone this way, or let's use a different color, or this way. Okay. And now, because this object is sufficiently big, it'll interact with the gravitational field, with the metric. And for each of these two positions, you'll have some geometry. So you'll have some metric defined on a manifold, if you're thinking classically at least, so corresponding to this position and also one corresponding to this position. And this should be different because you have different mass distributions in these two cases. So it's just, there's the metric distribution. Okay. It's just my attempt to draw a metric on a manifold. But now there's a problem, which is that in general relativity, you can't really identify the points in different solutions. So if a point here in this solution and one over here in this solution, you can't really identify them. And the reason for this is that solutions in general relativity are only defined up to general coordinate transformations. They don't have meaning beyond a given a coordinate transformation. So this solution only has meaning up to a certain coordinate transformation, and likewise this one. So you can't really talk about identifying this point with this point. This has to do with the hole argument. Have any of you heard of the hole argument? You have? Yeah. Good. The hole argument is something that it stopped Einstein making progress because he was concerned about this problem. I can just tell you the argument quickly. So imagine this is now just classical general relativity. You can imagine that you're Einstein back in 1913. And imagine you have a region of your manifold, a region of space-time, and then it's surrounded by another region. Now imagine you know everything. You know the metric around here, but you don't know the metric inside here. what you can use the Einstein field equations to find the metric in here. And you'll get a certain solution for that using these boundary conditions. The only problem is that the Einstein field equations are invariant under general coordinate transformations. So you could perform a general coordinate transformation that just affects the coordinates inside this hole without affecting the coordinates outside. And so you transform this in your different coordinate system, marked with prime, you'd get a different solution. The only thing is that these equations look the same with regard to your new coordinate system, which means that you must also have this new solution must also be a solution in the original coordinate system. So now you have two solutions that look different, two different solutions for your metric inside this hole, even though you had all the boundary conditions you could possibly hope to have had. So it means that the Einstein field equations don't give you a unique solution, even no matter how much boundary information you give yourself. And the usual solution to this is to say, well, because these equations are invariant under general coordinate transformations, the coordinate system you use is essentially gauge, and the physical meaning of these solutions is the thing you have left over after you've modded out of all possible general coordinate transformations inside this region. Okay. So this is the argument that Penrose is using here, that you can't really identify x's between the two different solutions because there's no meaning to that x. But then you have a problem, which is if you want to evolve this using the Schrodinger equation, you need some time coordinate. So you can evolve this superposition of two different metrics, but you don't have a sensible way of identifying a time coordinate. Penrose then says, well, this is all wrong. Something has got to give. So this is not a constructive argument. This is just saying, well, there's a problem here. Something has got to go wrong. And the thing he thinks has to happen, the thing that's got to give, is that we have to have a wave function collapse. That kind of solves the problem. If the wave function collapses onto one of these two terms, then you don't have to identify these points. Yeah. Well, if you're going to use a wave function, even in quantum field theory, you would still you'd still write it down in some Hamiltonian form, so you'd evolve the wave function forward,
You would have something like the Klein-Gorman equation,
right?
Where time is not a special coordinate.
Well, if you want to actually write down a sort of wave functional on your so you have amplitudes for different fields. Different field configurations, then you'd have to evolve it forward. I think that if you try to put quantum field theory in this setting, then you would need you may be able to get around it using sort of something like topological quantum field theory, where you associate states to boundaries and so on. But I think if you're going to use the techniques that you'd use to talk about a wave function here, typically, then you'd have to evolve it in time. Yep.
What separates the Planck mass, what makes it special here, like this argument,
would
hold for anything, right?
That's true, yeah, absolutely, yeah. So this is not a constructive argument, there's not actually a theory here. Penrose pretty much sort of just you know chose. Actually, I'll give you an expression for a moment. The expression he gives for when this effect is, he thinks this effect will be non-trivial. Yeah. I mean, he imagined it would correspond. I mean, this is all heuristic arguments on his part. But he imagined it would correspond to something like the exchange of a graviton, that this effect will become big. I mean, there's a similar argument even just before you get to gravity. Imagine you have an electron going through an interferometer. Now, we know that if we slowly increase the charge on the electron, this is an argument, I think, due to Haradov. If you slowly increase the charge on the electron, at a certain point, you'll be able to do a measurement later to find out which way the charge went, because the charge will be sufficiently big, it will leave an imprint in the electromagnetic field, and you'll be able to see which way the particle went through the interferometer. So you'd have to lose interference in that case. But we know that if you only have just a single electron, well, people have seen interference with single electrons. And so clearly quantum theory is playing an essential role, that somehow by quantizing the electromagnetic field, you allow the possibility of interference for small charges. And so something similar might happen in this case. Although Penrose is actually making a slightly stronger claim here. Because in the case of the electromagnetic charge, what's happening is you're getting entanglement with the electromagnetic field. So fundamentally, your system is still evolving unitarily. Whereas Penrose is making the argument that because of this identification issue, you can't imagine evolving the state unitarily in this case. And so something has to give, and he thinks it's collapse. You have to have collapse.
Yeah, so I would expect it if I was to take a very large correlated number of electrons and set up a device where all the electrons definitely take one path, or all the electrons definitely take the other path.
Mm.
As soon as you try detecting excitations in the field along one of the two paths, everything breaks down.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is actually you have kind of no choice, because the mere fact that thing has so much charge, so even if you don't set up an experiment at the time, let me find some space here. Even if you don't set up an experiment at the time, so your electron goes this, or your charge goes this way or this way, and later on you do some interference over here. You could imagine later on doing an experiment. Later on, at some later time after the particle has gone through this interference region, and you've detected it, you could later on introduce a device, a charge. Imagine releasing a charge on a little spring, kind of a test charge, on a sort of spring, and it will deflect one way or the other. As long as you get your timing correct.
So you have to destroy all the information about the field.
And you kind of can't, because it's already there imprinted in the field. So.
Well, but as long as the field's in some kind of superposition itself and dissipates.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a strong argument, so it's not a problem anyway. I mean, otherwise, why wouldn't that happen for a single
electron? Well, that's the question. I haven't ever gone through the calculation carefully to point to the exact point at which the thing is happening. But the quantization is clearly essential in the case of an electron. And that's what allows you not to think in terms of continuous fields where this would be a problem. Yeah. And I don't know a reference where someone has really done this. This argument, I've heard it from Sandu Popescu, which is via Aharonov. But I don't know of any papers that have really spelled out how this is working out. Okay, so that's the argument that Penrose gives. And so Penrose also suggests a few formulas. So he suggests a time scale for the collapse. the RC has a similar claim. And actually, the only difference between the two cases is that they give different formulas, suggested formulas for this E delta E. This is some energy. And the one that Penrose gives is this. So the idea is that you have a matter distribution and another matter distribution given by rho and rho prime. And then you're calculating this funny object here, which is, what does he call it? He calls it the he calls it the gravitational self-energy. Yeah, that's a question that I don't know how Penrose asks that. I assume he's here just sort of trying to do a calculation. Well, he's not worrying about that issue and just as a calculation. It's all heuristic. So this is not really a proper theory. And certainly, if I just have a particle that's here or here, in the standard way of thinking, I can do that. But you're right, it's a good point. Of course, the gravitational self-energy.
Do you have any references
for the
any references to papers on this?
I'll dig them out and I'll send them to Abby. Yeah. He has written a few, at least one paper, maybe more on this. Yeah. Okay. So now it's 12:15. So let me. So what I want to do next is to talk about this explicit collapse model, which is the Girardi-Rimini-Weber model. So I gave you a motivation for why it's reasonable to think about collapse. Now I'm going to give you an explicit model, and I won't have time to finish this today. I'll just get started. So the model is called the GRW model, but the presentation I'm going to give you is due to John Bell. And if any of you have looked at the nice little book, which is a collection of John Bell's papers, this is the paper called, I think that book's called Speakables and Unspeakables in Quantum Theory. This is the paper called Are There Quantum Jumps? Okay, so we're going to give an interpretation. So I need to give you the ontology and the dynamics. So consists of two things. First of all, we have a wave function. N particles. Then the second thing we have is this is curious. It's a way to get what are called local bubbles. This is John Bell's expression. And the problem of having local bubbles is that if you've just got this wave function, this lives on configuration space. It's not obviously providing you with a picture of a three-dimensional world of tables and chairs. And so the idea was to try and find out what it is, what's the object that actually gives you the world of three-dimensional chairs. And so there's two solutions. Well, two suggestions to this. One is due to Bell. And he has what's called the flash ontology. So the model will consist of jumps, discrete jumps that happen every so often. These are the sort of flashes. And then the idea here is that the local bubbles, the things that make up the familiar world of three-dimensional objects, are composed of these flashes. And then the other ontology is due to Gherardi and collaborators. A different set of collaborators from these ones. And they have what's called the mass density collaboration, the mass density ontology. Okay. So that's the first thing is the ontology. And then the second thing is the dynamics. The dynamics is Schrodinger leaf evolution, except when these jumps occur. And then we get a different, then we have a specific jump process. So I'll take you through this jump process tomorrow. So there's some explicit equations which govern this jump process in this proposed model. Let me just give you the rough idea. So the idea is that every particle is subject with some very small probability to undergoing a jump. And when the jump happens, the wave function is modified using an operator which acts on the argument associated with the given particle. So now if you have a small system consisting of just a few particles, well, because this jump process is very unlikely, so for a given particle, the proposed numbers were that the jump process happens every 10 to the power 8 years. You essentially never see a collapse. So if you have a particle, or just a few particles, going through an interferometer, it's very likely that the particle will travel all the way through the interferometer without experiencing any jump. So you have a very small reduction in the interference arising from the jump process for small particles. On the other hand, and I'll take you through this in more detail, if you have a big object, like a pointer, which can be in one of two positions, orange this time, then if the pointer is in this position and a single particle in the pointer, you have a particle which, you know, imagine the particle is either here or here, this one. You see that all these particles are very correlated with each other, so that if one particle undergoes a collapse, then effectively you take the whole wave function with you. So all the particles will undergo collapse as well. So just a single particle collapsing is enough to bring the whole superposition down. And so you get a definite pointer state. And because you have so many particles in this pointer, roughly Avogadro's number, it's very likely that in a very short time interval, one of these particles will cause a collapse. So that's the rough idea of the model. And what I'll do tomorrow is I'll go through it in more detail. And I'll stop there.